That was Charles Turner, from whom we'll hear throughout the evening, with selections from both Abraham Lincoln and Frederick Douglass. And by way of a brief introduction in the role I learned I would have about 48 hours ago as moderator, we should keep in mind, since this is a Lincoln-Douglass debate, I guess, or discussion, that 2 days after Frederick Douglass gave that speech, Abraham Lincoln gave a major speech, a eulogy to Henry Clay, in which he said, reiterated his belief that all men are created equal, but said in addition that Henry Clay's colonization society was worth remembering and extolling on that day of days. He reminded his listeners that the pharaohs of Egypt were punished severely by plagues for keeping a captive people among them who didn't wish to be there. So here we are on the 4th of July and the 6th of July, 1852, with these future leaders, Douglass already a leader, Lincoln about to become a national leader, with quite a different point of view. What do we make of where they are? David, why don't we start with you?
Well, Douglass would have loved the Egyptian metaphor, I think. Although both of Lincoln's points were harbingers of things to come. Let me just say that Douglass's 4th of July speech, I think, is the rhetorical masterpiece of American abolitionism. And if you've never read it, read it. It is like a symphony in three movements. The beginning of the speech, first 3 to 4 pages, Douglass pays tribute to the founding fathers. He calls the 4th of July the American Passover. He calls the Declaration of Independence the ringbolt of American liberty. And his audience of 600 people in Corinthian Hall in Rochester must have been feeling very good about themselves for inviting Frederick Douglass. But then the pronouns begin to rain down on them. It's your 4th of July. You may rejoice. I must mourn. You, your, dozens of times. And for the next 20 minutes, the second movement of the speech is this hailstorm about American hypocrisy, about this terrible contradiction. He also takes them through a litany of the horrors of the slave trade and of slavery, and he reaches a crescendo with a metaphor about a reptile resting at the heart of the nation about to eat it out. And then comes the third movement. The last little part of the speech, after this hailstorm, it's as if Douglass picks the people up off the floor and wipes their brows and says, but it's not too late. The nation is still malleable. It might yet save itself from its fate. It's one of the great American speeches, I think, ever, rhetorically and oratorically. I think it's the greatest abolitionist speech because of its ultimate subject, which is the meaning of the United States and the meaning of slavery and freedom in a republic.
Well, one of the things that's happening is Douglass is filling a role that traditionally in American society oppressed Americans have filled. That is the role of the national conscience. He recognized, as many of those in slavery and those fighting against slavery recognized, the fact that slavery was America's great contradiction. I mean, can you imagine? This is a nation that comes into existence saying to the world, we're not like other nations. We are different. And the thing that makes us different is that we hold these truths to be self-evident that all men are created equal, endowed by their creator with certain inalienable rights. And what are they? Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And the nation that comes into existence saying that is the nation that tolerates the institution of slavery. And what Douglass is saying is, look at yourself in the mirror. Explain to yourself how you are not hypocrites. And he says it in the most forceful way. You know, that's one thing about Douglass. Douglass had a way with language. You know, sometimes I think that one of the worst things that happened in American 19th century racial intolerance and racial restriction is that a man like Frederick Douglass could never become president of the United States. We as a nation would have benefited by having Frederick Douglass president of the United States. I mean, imagine. Maybe we wouldn't have Franklin Pierce. Maybe we wouldn't have James Buchanan. Maybe we wouldn't have a variety. Johnson, Andrew Johnson. Suppose we could replace those with a Frederick Douglass. Would we not be better as a nation? I would open that to debate. I think we would. Well, the fact is that Douglass says what Americans needed to face at the time, and he said it in a way that you couldn't ignore. I think that's one of the most important things about Douglass during this time, is he really did fill the role that America needed, and that is of a conscientious conscience.
I want to deal a little bit tonight with, all speeches are not created equal, and the hearers and the readers of the speech are the ones who determine the immediate impact of them. Lincoln's Henry Clay eulogy, which Lincoln students are quite familiar with, actually has quite limited reproduction and audience at the time. Tell us about who heard and read, aside from the 600 people, who read the 4th of July oration that year? Do we know? Was it in Douglass's Monthly? Was it reprinted? Was it widely?
Parts of it were. Parts of it was printed in Douglass's Monthly and also in the Liberator. There were parts of it. And it became in some ways like the rumor of the time, where it was kind of passed around, at least parts of it, passed around from abolitionist meeting to abolitionist meeting, because after all, what Douglass was saying is what many abolitionists said in a variety of ways, and that is, if you are a citizen in a free society, one of your responsibilities is to push your society in the direction of fulfilling its stated goals. That's what Douglass is saying. He's saying, you have talked the talk, now you must walk the walk.
How old is Douglass in 1852?
He's, well, what is it, 18?
18.
So figure that out.
He's 34.
34.
34 years.
It's pretty remarkable. So Lincoln is 43. If you read the language of that speech, he has not achieved mature style. Forget about the content for a minute, but in terms of development, he's lagging behind Douglass both in breadth of vision and in stylistic ability.
The ability Douglass had at such a young age to wield words, in the narrative which he writes when he's only 27, and in his beginning career as an orator, is still astonishing, I think, even to scholars who study Douglass in depth. How could such a young man, a former slave, use language as he did? Of course, there are real roots to that. He's a very lucky guy when he's a slave to come by language as he does, to learn his alphabet, to have access to newspapers, access to language, especially the Bible. And yet there also is an extraordinary gift in both of these men to find the music of words in their heads. And Douglass, I think, the only way one can ultimately explain it with Douglass is to realize how much as a youth he actually read the cadences of the Bible and how much he practiced with that little book he purchased by bartering called The Columbian Orator, which Lincoln also studied in Illinois as a young man.
And one of the things I enjoy telling my students, the risks he took in holding a book. He was a slave in Maryland. It was illegal for a slave to have a book, for you to teach a slave to read. And here was a person willing to risk whatever horrible things could happen to a slave caught with a book, willing to risk that in order to gain knowledge. I say that because we've got students in society today that need to understand what a privilege they have and how they should not waste it, how Frederick Douglass would come back to get them if he knew that they were wasting this opportunity that he fought so hard for. I mean, he was such a bright guy that his master's wife, seeing this bright kid, taught him how to read. She knew it was illegal. She took a chance doing that, and when his master found out, he read her the Riot Act. You don't teach a slave to read. Well, part of the reason Douglass understood that you don't teach a slave to read is because knowledge is power. He knew that, and he used that knowledge as power all of his life.
The only physical possession Douglass carried out of slavery with him in his escape was the Columbian Orator, other than some cash in his pocket that Anna gave him.
Just to skip a bit, we have just to keep our chronology moving here, and we'll skip past the terms of Professor Horton's favorite presidents, Franklin Pierce and James Buchanan. bring us to 1860, when Abraham Lincoln gives a speech in three movements at Cooper Union. So he's 8 years, lagging behind about 8 years. The speech that I argued helped make him president, but in a way is still a rather conservative speech in some ways. In some ways it's enlightened. Also three messages. One, the founders agreed that the federal authority was there to prevent the spread of slavery. Second movement, a warning to the South that it would not be a northern, the North would not be responsible for driving them out of the Union, that they were not threatening their slaves. And third, the wonderful appeal to Republicans to rally and remember that the truth was on their side. Here's another extraordinary coincidence. A few days after that, Frederick Douglass gives a major speech in Scotland in which he turns this argument, which he hasn't read, but the notion that accepting slavery where it exists is okay, turns that on its ear. It says it's un-American. It's a violation of what the founders say. And here again, this play of who sees the speech is important. Douglass is in self-imposed exile or on a speaking tour. We all know that that can be the same thing in Scotland. And he can't get anybody to publish this speech except a publisher in Halifax, which I guess dooms it to scant distribution. Meanwhile, Abraham Lincoln helps organize, and you know, in a Victorian manner, he acquiesces in the organizing of publication in the New York Tribune, the New York Post, the New York Times. He reads proof himself, publishes pamphlets in
New
York.
That's called self-promotion.
Yeah. We don't know anything about that. Where are these fellows now in 1860? Lincoln becomes the compromise candidate of the Republican Party. Douglass is not happy with Lincoln's campaign. So take us to the brink of 61.
Well, you know, African Americans generally are alarmed that an Abraham Lincoln is the Republican candidate for the presidency, and they are very critical of Lincoln's stands in the past on issues of race, in the past on issues of the American Colonization Society's plan to colonize African Americans on the west coast of Africa. They see Lincoln as a potentially dangerous candidate. Now, Douglass basically says to many of the African American leaders, don't be too hard on the guy. Because, and I think this is the way Douglass felt during these early years, he's the best we got. You know, what Douglass felt is the way, certainly the way I feel sometimes, and that is you don't often get to vote for the person you want. You have to vote for the person who is not as bad as the other people you might vote for. And that's what Douglass was saying, basically. He was saying, this man is not our candidate, but he's the best we can do given the circumstances. And I think he was right.
Well, Douglass supported Lincoln in 1860, but at some arm's length. Mm-hmm. He'd had an up-and-down relationship with the Republican Party since its inception. What Douglass did in the 1850s is he tended to support the Republicans in election years, and then in off-year elections he would support the Radical Abolition Party in upstate New York, which got 40 or 50 votes. Actually, a few more than that. But what Douglass really wanted in 1860 is ultimately what happened, which is astonishing if we think about it. He wanted a breakup of some kind to happen between North and South. He wanted some kind of crisis, some kind of, if possible, even disunion. And he saw in the Republican Party the potential to cause that. I mean, I'm not saying he predicted it and he knew what was coming, but it was that potential, and he uses that very word, the tendencies of the Republican Party to threaten the South that gave Douglass a sort of party of hope.
But there's also astonishing article in Douglass's Monthly after Lincoln's election in which Douglass says, why on earth the South would contemplate secession when this slave catcher, which he calls Lincoln, the slave catcher, because of his past support for enforcement of fugitive slave laws, why are they contemplating secession with such a man as the president?
Well, for much of the free African-American community, the thought of the South removing itself from the United States, said differently, removing slavery from the protection of the U.S. I mean, think about it. When John Brown invaded Harper's Ferry in 59, he was finally, his raid was finally halted not by the state militia of Virginia, but by the U.S. military. And what African Americans thought was to take slavery out of the United States was to remove slavery from the protection of the full force of the U.S. military. In fact, I'll quote Charles Lennox Ramon, who said to a group of African Americans in Pennsylvania after hearing that South Carolina was thinking about seceding, he said to South Carolina, "Stand not on ceremony, go at once."
Douglas feared compromise in 1860. He fully expected there would be another compromise of 1850 of some kind because he didn't know what else to have faith in. In fact, after Lincoln's election, of course, the secession winter of 1860-61 was a terrible time for abolitionists. Douglas, in fact, got himself beaten up in Tremont Temple in Boston. And it was a December or January 60 or 61. So he fully expected somehow there probably would be another compromise of these issues, and he did not yet have full faith of it.
No, but I
well,
mean
there
the
certainly
Crittenden
was. The
group
compromise being the most noted. But he didn't know how to put real faith in the Republican Party yet because it didn't have enough history.
Well, because we want to get to the point where we can invite Charles to come back to the stage, we've got to keep advancing the chronology. So as choppy as it seems, we're going to push ahead past 61 into 62 with Frederick Douglass growing increasingly impatient that Lincoln is not playing the emancipation card to win the war that ostensibly what Lincoln will only concede to that point is to preserve or to restore the Union. Douglass is writing emphatically in the newspaper demanding that Lincoln move. How influential is he? Do you think that Lincoln is reading, hearing about this unrest, these demands?
Yeah, you know, Douglass is upset with Lincoln on many fronts. One thing is that, you know, as soon as the war begins, as soon as Lincoln puts out the call for troops, African Americans stand up. They are ready. You know, African Americans have been establishing militia companies in a variety of places, in New York, in Boston, in Cincinnati, and Philadelphia. They have been establishing these military militias, training, drilling, and so on, preparing for what they were absolutely sure would be a war on slavery. They've been doing this since the mid-1850s. So in 61, in the spring of 61, when Lincoln puts out the call for troops, they say, "We are ready." And the federal government turns them down. And Lincoln supports that. And Douglass is very unhappy. So that's one of the things. If, you know, what Douglass says is, why would the president try to fight this war with one hand tied behind his back?
Well, he was more than upset. He was outraged. In the fall of 61 and early 62, the Lincoln administration policy toward fugitive slaves was, of course, to return them to their owners if the owners were loyal to the Union, which eventually became virtually impossible for Union officers to determine. In the fall of 61 and then in the winter of 62, Douglass wrote his most vicious critiques of Lincoln that he ever wrote. He called Lincoln the most dangerous slave hunter in the country. And then he called him an itinerant colonization lecturer. He called him a, quote, genuine representative of Negro hatred. Douglass, at this very moment of the greatest hope in some ways of the possibility of a sanctioned war to destroy slavery, sees now a presidential administration and a military that is organized to return runaway slaves. And it's the most brutal rhetoric, really, that Douglass writes during the war, with the possible exception of his attacks on the Lincoln administration when they tried to make him their colonization czar.
Well, the moment comes, of course, in September. But before we get to it, and I'll confide to the audience that this is something that the three of us want very much to talk about and attack each other on. We've all discussed the imminent attack, or disagreement, shall I say. The extraordinary, disappointing, horrifying meeting that Lincoln has with a deputation, as it's called, of free African Americans from the Washington, D.C. area, who come to Lincoln and echo what Douglass has been writing, how long do we have to wait before freedom becomes a part of your program? Jim, maybe you should describe the event, and we'll go from there.
Well, first of all, you got to understand this is an extraordinary event. This is the President of the United States who is inviting black people to come to, not as servants, to come to the White House to have a meeting with him. So, I mean, this is virtually unheard of. There's been one time before Monroe had a black person that he met with for a very short time. But this is really without precedent. And so they come with great expectation. And what Lincoln says to them, among other things, what he says is basically, you guys need to go out and tell your people to support the idea of colonizing yourselves someplace outside of the country. He talks briefly about Africa, but he's open to any possibilities. Some places in Latin America, some places in the West Indies, somewhere. Just someplace outside of America. And one of the things they try to point out to him is, you know, we are Americans. You know, our ancestors fought in the war that made this a nation. Our ancestors...
They don't do it to his face.
No, they aren't allowed to.
They aren't allowed to. They have to go back to... They're really being...
They do in the newspaper, though.
Yes.
They
do
it
in a letter, right.
Yep.
Well, he started it. He had a newspaper man on the scene for this lecture and shared shared the text of what he'd written in advance.
Douglass was shocked by this and went on the attack. But go ahead. Are you going to?
What I was going to say is that they were, one, disappointed, but they were also just furious that here the President of the United States would. And, you know, you have to consider all this in the light of the history of the time because, in 1857, the Supreme Court of the United States had said in the Dred Scott decision, black people have never been, are not now, and can never be citizens of the United States. And so Lincoln, incidentally, disagreed with that.
But not in that speech.
But not publicly, not in a more public way. But... he seemed to be saying to them, you know, your place is outside of the nation.
Yeah, and you have to understand that in the context of this is the White House itself. These are five handpicked black leaders, so-called, from Washington, D.C., and they are told in explicit terms, our two peoples, quote, must be separated. And then in a lengthy part of that address, Lincoln tells them that they really should think about Central America, where they have good coal mines and good ports. And then he says to them in the end, help me. You should volunteer yourselves. He says, give me 20, 50, even 100, and we can start this process. He asks them to sacrifice themselves for the good of the nation by leaving. It's Lincoln's worst racial moment. Happily, he had a better month coming up.
Actually, he also, the most, before I defend him, which I promised to do. He also told them that they were the cause of all the difficulties.
Right. Your people are the cause of our difficulties.
Right.
The other thing you have to understand is how this idea of colonization had been playing in the free black community. You know, what we have seen in the 1820s and 1830s is that many black institutions are changing their names. They initially had a lot of institutions named with Africa or African in the title. So, for example, the African Baptist Church in Boston, which was started in 1805, one of the earliest black churches. But in the 1830s, it changes its name to the First Independent Church of the Free People of Color. And they explain why, for the very important reason that the name African is ill applied to an organization of American citizens. What they are doing here is they're not so much rejecting Africa as they are rejecting the American Colonization Society. 1816, the American Colonization Society forms, and their whole purpose is to get blacks out of America and to Africa. You know, they're the people that set up Liberia in the early 1820s, and they want to get blacks out of America. So what they are really doing is defending themselves against the program of the American Colonization Society. So to have Lincoln say this is a slap in the face that comes at the end of a long process of trying to remove yourself from the target of the colonization movement.
So are you ready for my defense?
Yes.
Okay. Can't wait.
See it. We're listening.
Lincoln has already written a first draft of the Emancipation Proclamation when he holds this meeting. At William Seward's suggestion and good explanation, we've done so badly in the field that this is going to be seen like the Pope's bull against the comet, so table it, and he does. I view this as part of his disinformation campaign. It was very Nixonian. I'm not saying that's a compliment, but it was very Nixonian. He is telling his white audience, why else have a reporter from the mainstream white press on the scene? He's telling his white audience in the border states, which he is petrified of losing to the Confederacy, and the whole game, as he puts it, rather blithely, but it's a good metaphor, that this war is not to liberate black people and place them among you. I am for deportation. As ugly as it is, a few weeks later, he writes a letter to Horace Greeley, which is all very famous, but is equally disingenuous without being quite as offensive. He says, whatever I do about slavery, I do to save the Union. What I forbear to save the Union. Well, he's now days away from the Emancipation Proclamation when he writes this. This is part of his public relations campaign to prepare white America. Now, I think it is, for a genius of public relations and writing, it was a terrible mistake. Because as Lincoln later put it, if my name ever goes down in history, it will be for this act. So he miscalculated terribly for posterity. Forget about the human reaction. But that's what I see this absurd, invite people in for the first time, tell them the whole war is all their fault, and tell them to not only get out of the White House, but get out of town. That's my explanation.
Out of the country.
And out of the country.
He may have been trying to condition public opinion at all times, and he was brilliant at it, but he still has Montgomery Blair, a cabinet member, appealing after both Emancipation Proclamations in 63 to none other than Frederick Douglass to come join the government and run the colonization program. It couldn't have been a more offensive thing to do. Now, it's possible Lincoln didn't even sign off on that. He just gave Montgomery Blair responsibility for running colonization if they could ever pull it off. There could not have been a more offensive act toward black America than that overture to Douglass to run the colonization plan.
Well, that's true, but you know, one thing you also have to understand in terms of assessing Lincoln during this period, don't forget, Lincoln is under tremendous pressure. You know, when Lincoln runs for the Senate in Illinois in 1858, he has these debates with the other Douglas. I'm talking about the Stephen A. Douglas in the senatorial campaign. And Stephen A. Douglas says to the Illinois audience, he says, you know, this guy will not only lead... His policies will not only lead to the end of slavery, but these policies are going to lead to racial equality. And then he really hits them. He promotes interracial marriage, he says. Now, here's Abraham Lincoln running for the Senate in Illinois, 1858, and he's got to defend himself against supporting interracial marriage. You know what Lincoln says? He says, look, you know, Senator Douglas says it's confused. He ought to understand that just because I do not want a Negro woman for a slave does not mean I necessarily want her for a wife. Well, he goes on through this whole litany of trying to defend himself against these charges. And so much of what we're hearing here is what Lincoln has to say in order to remain viable as a political candidate, and as we move to the election of 1860, where he's running for the presidency of the United States, he really has to make himself acceptable to not only the North, but to the border states, because we got a lot of states that are slave-holding states, states like Delaware, for example. My home state of New Jersey still has 16 slaves that are freed by the 13th Amendment in 1865. So we have states that are going to remain in the United States that are...
But Jim, let's ask Harold.
Yeah, what?
Were all those gradual plans of emancipation that he offered to Delaware and Kentucky and so on, were those all nothing but public relations as well? Lincoln preferred gradualism. Instinctively, he preferred gradualism.
But I like what... this is by way of not answering your question. I like what Douglas...
Moderator, I forgot.
I like what Douglas said in September, or I guess in October 62, in response to the preliminary proclamation, he said, Lincoln is guilty of slothful deliberation, but because of his slowness, he will never be guilty of retraction.
Well, and that turns out to be true.
And what was your question again? So, well, in what period are we talking? We should just move ahead so we can get to the watershed year of 63, that the proclamation is issued, a 100-day countdown to its final effect for the final proclamation. And then in December 1862, Lincoln gives his annual message to Congress, which is what today's State of the Union messages are, except the presidents don't go and deliver them themselves. They send a clerk. They send a written copy. They're read aloud, probably in a desultory manner by a clerk. But people get to read it all across the country, and we remember this ringing peroration, we cannot escape history. We will be remembered in spite of ourselves. The fiery trial through which we pass will light us down in honor or dishonor to the latest generation. In giving freedom to the slave, we assure freedom to the free. But we should also acknowledge what preceded that, which is extraordinary for December 1st, 1862.
It's a long appeal for colonization. It's yet in the presidential annual message. That's a gorgeous piece of rhetoric, and it still rings when you hear it. And it is ultimately a kind of explanation of what the war is beginning to do, ex post facto, but it comes after a very formal appeal for colonization as one way of settling this problem.
And compensated emancipation.
Yeah, but one thing we have to understand, though, is that after Abraham Lincoln issues the formal Emancipation Proclamation in 63... A month later, he does not return to the question of colonization. He doesn't build colonization in as a condition for emancipation. He never speaks publicly about colonization again. Now, I argue that what happens is that after the Emancipation Proclamation, and very important, after the role that African Americans play in the war itself, and after he comes to know Frederick Douglass, Lincoln undergoes a marked change, that the man that we see in 64 and 65 is not the man that we have seen in the early 60s or in the 50s.
And
Lincoln's greatest capacity was growth, and this is where it happens.
Capacity for personal growth. Don't let anybody tell you about flip-flopping, because Abraham Lincoln is my A number one American flip-flopper. He flipped and flopped in the right direction. He learned from experience, he learned from history. And it seems to me that's the mark of greatness, a person who shows a capacity for personal growth. So if you want to call that flip-flopping, I wish we had some other people who would flip and flop in that direction.
Well, as we move towards 63 and we examine the question of whether some of that flipping and flopping was influenced directly by Frederick Douglass, let's go to the poetry that paralleled the prose of the Emancipation, because as a document, it is dry and legalistic. We won't go into the cliches about it, but at Gettysburg in November 1863, Lincoln gives some poetic voice to this new vision for America. Charles Turner.
Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, November 19th, 1863. 47 years ago, our fathers brought forth upon this continent a new nation, conceived in liberty, and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal. Now we are engaged in a great civil war, testing whether that nation or any nation so conceived and so dedicated can long endure. We are met on a great battlefield of that war. We have come to dedicate a portion of that field as a final resting place for those who here gave their lives that that nation might live. It is altogether fitting and proper that we should do this. But in a larger sense, we cannot dedicate, we cannot consecrate, we cannot hallow this ground. The brave men, living and dead, who struggled here have consecrated it far above our poor power to add or detract. The world will little note nor long remember what we say here, but it can never forget what they did here. It is for us, the living, rather, to be dedicated here to the unfinished work which they who fought here have thus far so nobly advanced. It is rather for us to be here dedicated to the great task remaining before us, that from these honored dead we take increased devotion to that cause for which they gave the last full measure of devotion, that we here highly resolve that these dead shall not have died in vain, that this nation, under God, shall have a new birth of freedom, and that government of the people, by the people, for the people, shall not perish from the earth.
And here, flip-flopping approaches the realm of the sublime. And you have this magnificent expression of American purpose. I wonder, really, whether Lincoln was growing as much as he was feeling liberated to express a nature that he was unable to express, a belief that he was unable to express for some time. I think we always have to keep in mind that he was operating in a terribly racist society. He talked about stretching the limits of the possible, as he put it, and there are things that were not possible, beginning with the Lincoln-Douglas debates. And does anybody want to comment on where Lincoln is at this moment?
Well, he's come to where Douglas is. The central metaphor of the Gettysburg Address, as you heard, is rebirth. It's the rebirth of a nation. It's the death of the old, the birth of the new. It's going to be something different. It isn't perfectly defined yet. That'll take a new constitution. That same month, November of 63, Douglas took a speech on the road that he gave almost countless times that winter and the next year called The Mission of the War. That speech was almost 2 hours long, and Lincoln's was, what,
2 minutes.
2 minutes. But the central metaphor of Douglas's Mission of the War speech is what he called national regeneration. And in December of 63, the next year's annual message, State of the Union, Lincoln's central metaphor of that annual message, which has nothing in it about colonization anymore, is what he calls the disenthrallment of the nation from slavery and its, therefore, regeneration. It's as though Douglas and Lincoln started at very different places, but they virtually now come to the same script. And I think they become kind of the subjunctive and declarative voices of a new revolution. Now, how much they're exactly influencing each other is another matter. It's hard to know.
But I think you also have to understand what Lincoln has done here. Lincoln, through the Emancipation Proclamation and with the Gettysburg Address, what he has said not only to America but to the world, and this is important because the whole world was watching, and in Europe, in England, in France, in Germany, there were people who were watching and trying to make their decision about whether they should support the Confederate States of America, whether they should recognize the Confederate States of America. One of the things that Lincoln did by issuing the Emancipation Proclamation was to say to this world, this war is more than simply about our internal struggle to hold the nation together. It is about the struggle for freedom. And that said to the abolitionist forces in England and France and Germany, what it said to those abolitionist forces is, you're for freedom, we're for freedom. Stand with us. And so what then happened is that those abolitionist forces put pressure on those individual governments so that Europe never did recognize the Confederacy. That's important. Because if Europe had and supplied the Confederacy, the war may have had a very different outcome.
You know, it's fascinating how the historiography has evolved on this subject. For 30 or 40 years, the impact on potential European intervention has been dismissed as an influence or an impact of the Emancipation Proclamation. If you look at Douglas, Douglas says immediately that the Emancipation decreases the potential for European intervention because it makes the Civil War a war about a cause rather than a war about national pride. Mm-hmm. Liberty versus Union. And it's I agree with you. And I think, you know, no one is really taking this that seriously, this the European aspect.
Well, you know,
it deserves to be reexamined fully.
A historian, James McPherson, has written about the literally months before the Battle of Antietam, which incidentally was the key battle that Lincoln used as his way of introducing to the nation the fact that he was going to be issuing an Emancipation Proclamation. And what Jim McPherson finds is that immediately before that battle, there were calls for meetings in Europe to consider the possibility of recognizing the Confederacy. So, I mean, this is pretty close in terms of time.
The British did consider sending a fleet to Canada. Yes, there's a marvelous book on the debate within Britain about intervention. It's called Divided Hearts by Richard Blackett. It shows beautifully what a rich debate, controversial debate, that the British had over the American Civil War. It's astonishing.
Which Lincoln knows about because he's in correspondence.
Sure. And both sides were competing in Britain to found newspapers to win this debate in Britain. Because if Britain had entered, I mean, if you just change the events and play counterfactuals, had Britain really entered this war in 1862, especially with its navy, it could easily have had a different outcome.
Let's go back from the poetry to the prose again, because the reality here is that with the final proclamation comes an importuning for people of color to join the ranks. All of these people who are drilling are getting the opportunity or the invitation to enlist and fight for their own freedom at long last. And yet, I don't want to give my take on the conversation. I'd rather turn it over to you both. But even here, Lincoln is a gradualist because salary levels for black troops are lower than that for white troops. And Douglas is involved in this, so why don't we set the scene there?
African Americans are at a disadvantage in many ways. One, African Americans, except with a very, very few exceptions, Delaney being one, with very few exceptions, African Americans did not serve as officers in their own units. Their units were commanded by white officers. The other thing is that when African Americans became soldiers for the United States, you notice I didn't say Union because the United States never changed its name. It was always the United States of America. So when they were fighting for the United States of America, the Confederate States of America issued an order that any black troops taken would not be treated as prisoners of war in the sense that they would not have the dignity and the treatment of generally accorded to prisoners of war. They'd be treated like runaway slaves. And, of course, the other thing was they were paid about half of what whites at comparable ranks were paid. So, well, $7 to $14. When you consider they had to pay for their uniforms, where whites got their uniforms for free. I mean, when you add all that stuff up, it becomes just about half. Now, Douglas was infuriated with this.
And this is why they first meet. Exactly. Douglas is invited to Washington, August of 63, by the Secretary of War Stanton, I think, initially. And then he actually gets an audience at the White House for probably about 45 minutes, it appears, to talk about unequal pay and discriminations ostensibly. They had quite an exchange of views, according to Douglas's testimony on this. And as Douglas says, we didn't agree on everything. But it is an extraordinary moment in this story because Douglas comes away from that first meeting, if not awed by Lincoln, deeply impressed by how he was treated.
There's a northern governor waiting outside, and he marches past the
right.
To the horror of the governor, I think.
Yeah,
Governor
sure.
Todd.
Douglas is very impressed with the seriousness with which he was treated by the president, with the fact that the president listened to him, not only talked to him, but actually listened to him. You know, at the end, Douglas says, you know, he is worthy of the name Honest Abe, because he was really impressed with the seriousness with which Lincoln considered his argument, and Douglas left that meeting convinced that Lincoln was going to take some steps to equalize the pay.
And out on the road after.
Lincoln hadn't said it directly, right. But Douglas was very sure that he was going to take some steps.
Well, he'll be initially disappointed by that. But out on the road after that, Douglas loved to tell this story of my first meeting with Lincoln. And there's this wonderful line. It sounds so uneloquent from Douglas, but he says, I felt big there, he says. He also came away with a promise from Secretary of War that he was going to get a commission to go into the South and be sort of chief recruiter of black troops, but that commission never came.
You know, the magic, the thing that can't be recreated, only alluded to in reminiscences, is the magical impact of Abraham Lincoln in a private meeting. And one of the other famous examples is when the great abolitionist Senator Charles Sumner had his first meeting with Lincoln, this man who was a living martyr to the cause of anti-slavery, and one of the most eloquent and well-educated of United States senators, comes to Lincoln for the first time, believing this is going to be a very easy guy to dominate. He's ill-educated and knows nothing, and when he leaves, he confides to someone that he's never met anyone who exhibited such intellectual superiority.
Yeah, that's the way Lincoln operated. Lincoln, as soon as you felt like, well, this guy doesn't know very much, you know, he's not very well educated, and I can probably twist him around my finger, Lincoln knew he had you. I mean, it was almost as if he was going for that. Now, the interesting thing is, okay, so now we've talked about 62, 63, we got the Emancipation Proclamation in force and so on, but now we're coming up to the 64 election. Now Lincoln has got to stand again for an election, and let me tell you, he is not popular with lots of people in the United States. I'm obviously not in the Confederate States of America, but not even in the United States. And Lincoln is worried about losing this election, big time. He's worried about losing this election.
Let's start with part one. You say he had to face re-election. I'm not at all sure he had to. He could have postponed the election and gotten away with it. But he didn't, and that's a remarkable thing for which he deserves, I think, enormous, enormous credit.
Isn't it the first time in history a functioning republic
in the midst of a civil war
has
allowed a Democratic
a general
vote
election.
Of the people?
Yeah. Yeah, and the next time you hear somebody talk about the ways in which Lincoln violated the Constitution during the Civil War, understand that if he was really interested in violating that Constitution, he could have said, hey, you know, we don't need to have an election in 64. I'm just going to continue to be your president because we're in the midst of a civil war. But he didn't do that.
In 62, in the general elections of 1862, just 2 months after he issued the preliminary emancipation, the Republican Party gets a real...
They got whacked.
What's the word? I've forgotten President Bush's word. A thumping.
Thumping.
Right. Right.
Yeah, that's what they called it, the thumping.
Which Republican. Is a big context
it
for
is
that
a big
proclamation,
context.
No question. And he takes great political risks.
He took enormous risks by issuing it in the teeth of an election campaign, and I think he does expect for the longest time in the 64 campaign that he's not going to be reelected.
Right.
So we ought to talk about...
Well, there's a movement within his own party
to dump him.
Yeah.
And get John C. Fremont back on the ticket, who had run in 1856, who was...
Or Ulysses S. Grant,
anyway. Or Grant, convinced Grant to leave the field.
In fact, Lincoln is so convinced that he might not be elected, and now we get an insight as to how he really felt about this Emancipation Proclamation that he had issued. Do you realize he calls Frederick Douglass to the White House, and he says, Fred, I want you to go into the I want you to recruit people who will go into the South, and I want you to get as many of those slaves as possible to U.S. lines, because I'm afraid that if I am not elected to the presidency the second term, whoever is elected is going to nullify the Emancipation Proclamation, and all those slaves will be just stuck there.
Timing of this is crucial. It's August of 64.
Yep.
The war is in a horrifying...
Before Atlanta.
War is in a horrifying stalemate in Virginia. Enormous casualties, tremendous war weariness across the North, which is why Lincoln's in such political trouble. And I frankly, from Douglass's reactions, I think Douglass could hardly believe what he was hearing. Mm-hmm. The president, Abraham Lincoln is asking him to organize some sort of John Brown scheme to get slaves funneled out of the South, get as many of them
before
freed
it's too late.
Before the election, before McClellan, the Democrat, who will give up the war, gets elected. It's an extraordinary encounter.
Well, what it says is that Lincoln is serious about getting these people to freedom.
At that point, absolutely.
At that point, there's no question.
And not to leave these good people with the idea that he called them Fred. We have to really say that
he called
them...
Yeah, do you really know he called him Fred?
Well, we know from what Douglass said that he called him Douglass.
Yeah.
Which was...
I don't think anybody called him Fred.
Oh, yes, people called him Fred.
Lincoln...
No, the only people who called him Fred were the racists who used to put up the posters saying Fred Douglas
Fred
is coming to town.
Douglas. Fred period Douglas.
Yeah,
Fred
right. He's coming to town and go out and protest. That's the only time Fred ever got. Anyway.
It's in the Lincoln-Douglas debate. Stephen talks about Fred Douglas
I'll
all
show
the time.
You a letter with Fred in it.
All right. Well, there's a T-shirt in Washington that had Freddie D on it. That's the one I wanted. I couldn't.
It was always Douglas.
They ran out there.
Anyway, Douglas is invited or gets to go to the second inaugural. To hear one of the most extraordinary speeches in American political history, and we're going to hear some highlights from the speech. So picture Abraham Lincoln on the south portico of the Capitol speaking to a vast throng, and Frederick Douglass, an eyewitness, an ear witness to history.
Saturday, March 4th, 1865. On the occasion corresponding to this 4 years ago, all thoughts were anxiously directed to an impending civil war. All dreaded it, all sought to avert it. While the inaugural address was being delivered from this place, devoted altogether to saving the Union without war, insurgent agents were in the city seeking to destroy it without war, seeking to dissolve the Union and divide effects by negotiation. 1/8 of the whole population were colored slaves, not distributed generally over the Union, but localized in the southern part of it. These slaves constituted a peculiar and powerful interest. All knew that this interest was somehow the cause of the war. Fondly do we hope, fervently do we pray, that this mighty scourge of war may speedily pass away. Yet if God wills that it continue until all the wealth piled by the bondsman's 250 years of unrequited toil shall be sunk, and until every drop of blood drawn with the lash shall be paid by another drawn with the sword, as was said 3,000 years ago, so still it must be said, the judgments of the Lord are true and righteous altogether. With malice toward none, with charity for all, with firmness in the right as God gives us to see the right, let us strive on to finish the work we are in, to bind up the nation's wounds, to care for him who shall have borne the battle, and for his widow, and for his orphan, to do all which may achieve and cherish a just and lasting peace among ourselves and with all nations.
Have you heard political speeches lately? Have you heard political speeches lately?
That's a bipartisan complaint.
Whoa.
No one.
Absolutely.
There is no. Yeah. And, well, that's a whole other subject.
Well, one thing we have.
But I think I blame the body politic for that, too. Wow. We don't demand very much anymore. We are satisfied with commercials and sound bites and things like that.
Maybe,
but anyway,
maybe
back to 1865.
Let's not go there.
It's not going to go there. No. But in 1865, you have. Mm-hmm. We have the most famous part of the speech, which is this reconciling paragraph that's so very famous about malice toward none, but in the paragraph before, what he's telling the people is that the sin of slavery is universal. Yeah. It doesn't belong only to the South. It's our sin too. Yeah. And
till every drop of blood drawn by the lash is paid for by blood drawn by the sword.
I think Douglass dreamed to write that speech.
Boy.
And could hardly believe Lincoln had delivered it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But there it was.
But you, and understand how that second inaugural is different from the first inaugural. In the first inaugural, no, what Lincoln said was that he had no intention to interfere with slavery in the places where it currently existed. What he was doing in the first inaugural was reassuring the South. In the second inaugural, he said, you know, we are paying the price for slavery. We have done an evil thing, and God is punishing us. And it may be, he says, that God is punishing us through this war. You know, 620,000 Americans die in that war. So, I mean, this is still the bloodiest war in American history. And so what he's saying is maybe we're paying this price because of the evil of slavery that we have tolerated. That's a different Lincoln than the Lincoln of 1860.
But that speech is also rooted in a very deep tradition in both of these men, as both of you know, which is this kind of millennial conception of a Christian view of history, of American history, a history that sometimes God or what 19th century folk often called divine providence would enter and cause a great change. Lincoln was in some ways a kind of millennialist, and certainly Douglas was. Mm-hmm. And that speech, if you read it closely, is a deeply kind of Old Testament speech, mm-hmm. yeah. as are many of Douglas's. Douglas would quote from the Old Testament at longer length often than Lincoln would. But one of the best ways to understand that second inaugural is it's Lincoln trying to explain the meaning of the war. Mm-hmm. And he can't just say you've died on the altar of liberty or you died on the altar of this or the altar. He can't explain all the death except in some kind of higher terms. Mm-hmm. And that's where he reaches for that kind of millennial tradition that it's possible had he ever read enough Douglas, and we'd have no idea how much Lincoln ever read Douglas, there might be some element of influence mm-hmm. here, although we have no empirical evidence that we know Douglas read Lincoln, but we don't know Lincoln read
Douglas.
But
one of the things that impresses me most about the inaugural is what happens after the inaugural. You know, in the party at the White House, after the inaugural, Abraham Lincoln, President of the United States, invites Frederick Douglass, ex-slave, to come to the White House for the party. Douglas comes to the front door, and they don't want to let him in. He's a black guy trying to get in the front door of the White House.
Two policemen stop
him. Yeah, right. And somebody says, no, he's a friend of the president. So they, yeah, really. So they let him in. Now, here is Abraham Lincoln standing in the midst of his guests, and he's talking about various things, and Frederick Douglass comes into the room. Lincoln looks across the room, and he says, oh, there's my friend Douglas. Come over here. I want you to ask, Douglas, come over. I want you to tell me what you think of my speech. He's talking about the inaugural. Come over, let me ask you what you think of my speech. And he says, there's no man in the country whose opinion I value more than yours. He says this not in a room of two or three people. He says this in the middle of a major celebration at the White House.
In the East Room.
In the East Room of the White House. You know, is this a president that you recognize as leader of the United States ever before? Never. And not very much since. Really.
Well, let's give Douglas's response. This is a sacred effort.
Yep.
Mr. President.
It was a sacred effort.
That was a sacred effort.
Good answer.
Yep. At the same time, white America is not quite so sure. Lincoln says people don't like being told that they are the beginners of a war. Mm-hmm. He says that to Thurlow Weed in a letter. He's concerned about it that he writes this to Thurlow Weed in response to a letter that had nothing to do with the second inaugural.
And malice toward none wasn't exactly everyone's attitude at that point.
That's true, too.
A lot of people wanted malice toward some.
A lot of people wanted malice towards a whole bunch of people.
We would like to spend some time before we hear a final oration from Frederick Douglass to entertain some questions. And we have some staff people with microphones. We'd love to get you involved in the discussion. We have two people over here.
Enjoyed the presentation and the give and take, but I thought that you, especially two of the people here, were a little hard on Lincoln earlier years. Being a historian myself, Lincoln was influenced by Jefferson and Clay, and his influence, I think that was not put out there. He's a Jeffersonian. Also, he's a pragmatist, Lincoln, but we also forget 1859, the John Brown raid. To Lincoln and to the South and to the North, this was a vicious raid against all humanity. And Lincoln had to soften the blow of the John Brown raid. And so that's a big effect on Lincoln's feelings and his actions. And I'd like you to comment on those two things, the Jeffersonian response and the John Brown.
John Brown's raid is indeed the subtext for that Cooper Union speech, which he addresses quite explicitly. And I think actually Lincoln's responses to John Brown were politically adroit and really quite brilliant. He, like other Republicans, condemned John Brown, said he must hang for this, but they often did it in a way that shined the even brighter light on the problem of slavery. So Lincoln actually did put John Brown to a kind of anti-slavery political use. Sure, he's influenced by Jefferson. Lincoln believed the Declaration of Independence was America's sacred text. It was its catechism. It was its Bible. And as did Douglas. That's what the 4th of July speech is all about, the ringbolt of your liberty. This is the endless great debate about Abraham Lincoln. Was he always and everywhere preparing himself to be the great emancipator? Or was he a man in intellectual evolution to a point of tremendous crisis where he became the willing emancipator? I mean, one of the questions always asked by students, or I prompt them often, is, you know, was Lincoln a willing or a reluctant emancipator? And I often answer by saying both. He would not have freed the slaves if this war only lasted 1 year. It doesn't take anything away from him. It wasn't his definition of what the war was about at the beginning. But obviously by the second year of the war, just as Harold said, he had the preliminary proclamation already drafted when he has that meeting with that black delegation. I don't completely buy the argument that it was all public relations, because there were some very real things going on to scheme about colonization. But this is a man of enormous intellectual growth through this period and this process. We could have had many other people as president who would never have done what he did.
Yeah. Well, you know, it is certainly true that Lincoln always said he hated slavery. But, you know, in Peoria in 1854, he said, but if I had all the power, I would not know what to do about this institution of slavery. During various times during the 50s, he said, we don't want to condemn slaveholders, he said, because, you know, if we had slaves in the North, we would be just like the slaveholders in the South. Now, that is not the Lincoln that, in 1865, says that, one, he thanks black soldiers. He said, you know, it is likely we would not have won that war if they had not intervened and helped us to win the war. And then he goes on to say that he believes that those who are particularly educated or military people ought to have the right to vote. Now, that is in direct opposition to what he has said in the late 50s when he was having this debate with Stephen A. Douglas, and he said, I am not in favor of black people as jurors, as voters. And he went on and on to talk about how he was in favor of the white race being the superior race. This is the race of which I am a member being the superior race. So that you can see a different Lincoln over time. And I argue that that difference can be explained by the way in which the world around him was changing. It is literally true that Lincoln was assassinated because at the end of his life, the last speech he ever gave is where he makes a bow in the direction of African-American citizenship. John Wilkes Booth is at that last lecture that Lincoln gives. And John Wilkes Booth says to his friend, he says, that's the last speech that man will ever make. And shortly after that, he kills him. So what you're seeing here is a Lincoln that goes from being moderately anti-slavery to a Lincoln that even the abolitionists recognize by the end of his life has become an abolitionist.
Let me comment around the periphery because I want to get some other questions in. I take Lincoln at his word in the Greeley letter that he believed that all men everywhere could be free. And I agree with Jim that he could not contemplate how to do it. Douglas saw a snake poised at the bosom of the body politic. Lincoln's metaphor, which he repeats on the train after the Cooper Union address, is that slavery is like a wen, a cancer. We don't know if we take it all out at once, we don't know whether the patient will die. This is the age of primitive medicine. One other, and does Lincoln change as much as the possibility? Again, what is the limit? What are the limits of the possible? Of course he changes, he matures, etc. He grows. I when people talk about that great moment in the Lincoln-Douglas debates, the horrific record he leaves of I would not make jurors of black people or equals in any way, remember the beginning of that rejoinder to Douglas. He starts out by saying, there have been reports that I favor Negro equality, and the audience reaction is laughter. Of course, it's not possible. It's a joke. It's a charge. It's a blasphemy from the opposition. Think of where the political mainstream is then. It's extremely right. It's extremely racist. And there was no way Lincoln could be elected, much less effective,
if
he was in any way more liberal than he was at that moment.
Well, and I would also add real quickly that we have a tendency in the United States to moralize all questions. There's nothing wrong with the fact that that Lincoln used the word necessity in the Emancipation Proclamation, that it was military necessity. He used that exact language. That's one good reason to free the slaves. And I've had many students over the years who say, he was only doing it for military necessity. And I often say, well, so what? It was militarily necessary.
Let's get another question.
And then it gave a higher moral purpose as well. So,
right on the aisle here, in the back.
I really love the vision of draft Douglas for president movement. And along that same line, something that I've been thinking about a lot is Reconstruction. So I want to push you just a little bit past 65. We know that Lincoln was thinking about Reconstruction. I don't know too much about Douglas's thoughts on Reconstruction, except he did say, now the work begins. But I'd really like to hear kind of a what if around your thoughts on the radical abolitionists and the radical Republicans' vision of Reconstruction. Was anybody else thinking about that? What were the visions that people were having as the war is coming to an end? We know what Johnson did, et cetera, but what could have been? What are some of the things that people were actually thinking about?
I think we
have.
Yep. Jim, you want to start?
Well, one of the things is that slavery was only part of the problem. Slavery was a lot of things. But one of the things it was a means of racial control. When slavery is abolished, how do we replace slavery's control of race? That's why Jim Crow, segregation, discrimination, and the segregationist laws become so much a part of the South. But it is also true that in the North, even though in most places, not all, but in most places in the North, slavery had disappeared by this time, that does not mean that racial equality had appeared. And so what we then had was what was going on in the South, and the Southerners, who were in the midst of this radically changed society in many ways, appealing to Northern assumptions about what, and this is a quote because this wasn't a reality, black rule in the South. There was never really black rule in the South. There were a few states in which blacks had a majority in the state legislatures and so on, but those were the states in which blacks had a majority in the population. But there was never this kind of black domination of the South. But the appeal to the nation that blacks were now dominating the South, and we all know that these inferior people are not fit to run a government and oppressing Southern white society, that appeal found belief in the North. And so that meant that Reconstruction was going to be curtailed and severely limited. That explains the Reconstruction that we got.
Very briefly, Frederick Douglass was a radical Republican. He saw the Civil War as a second founding. Destruction of the First Republic and the reinvention of a second. He loved the 13th Amendment. He was disappointed with the compromised character of the 14th Amendment, although completely supported it. The 15th Amendment he was initially disappointed with because it was kind of a halfway measure toward black suffrage, but ultimately supported that and led a great march in Baltimore to celebrate it. But in every way you could define a radical Republican in those 3 years that they were actually in power, that was Douglass's vision of Reconstruction, a true second creation of a new republic.
Questions? Well, let's do one down on this side here, just to keep him running around the aisles. It's part of the entertainment.
Perhaps a comment rather than a question. You've been talking about Lincoln more as an intellectual, and Douglas also as an intellectual. I think you forget, maybe because I'm both a history teacher and a legally trained, Lincoln was a lawyer. Lawyers have particular strategies. And one thing I see in Lincoln in the 50s, particularly in 60 at Cooper Union, very, very legalistic, and even when he becomes president, is he is setting up his strategy to win his case. And that's the only thing he's doing. And as the professor said, when the facts change, Lincoln's going to change. But it's not until the facts change. So the difference between the first inaugural address, I have to keep the Union together, because if I don't keep the Union together, I'm going to have a slave republic to the South. And the second inaugural address, I've destroyed the South with the Emancipation Proclamation. That, to me, is not a major change. That, to me, is the facts have changed. I got what I wanted.
I think
so
that's
I kind of go along with what Professor Blight said. You know, he was he wanted abolition all along.
I think you make a very good point about Lincoln's lawyerly tendencies, and you see that in his writing. Cooper Union is a good example. The annual messages, and, of course, the proclamation is written, as Richard Hofstadter said, with all the moral grandeur of a bill of lading, particularly because he was laying the groundwork to resist legal challenges if there would be, if the judiciary would hear cases challenging. Do we have time?
Well, your point about Douglass as an intellectual is, of course, well taken. There are even now books that treat him as a formal philosopher, no question.
We have a question right here.
Hi, I just have a question about Frederick Douglass's three autobiographies. I know he wrote three at different times in his life. And are there really important differences in the sort of political and stylistic character between these three, given the different years they were written and different phases of
There are lots of differences. His treatment of his parents, the extent he knows them, change over time. His treatment of his descriptive treatment of certain episodes change a good deal. The first autobiography is the short narrative, that brilliant little sort of summing up of his slave life. The second one, 10 years later in 1855, is a much more political document. It really fits that crisis political moment of the middle of the 1850s. He's become much more of a political abolitionist. The third one is the old man summing up a long life. It's 500 pages. It didn't sell as well. But rest assured, Douglass never stopped writing his autobiography, and he even revised the third. Never trust a man who writes three autobiographies and then revises the third one. He's trying to impose his biography on you, but thank God he wrote them.
We'll do one more in the back. All the way in the back.
That was a fabulous discussion, gentlemen. Thank you so much. I was curious, Harold, as to how important the white, the Union soldiers in the field were in getting Lincoln reelected.
Well, the Union soldiers, I think did you all hear the question? Well, how important would the soldiers' vote in the field in the reelection? Lincoln wins about 80% of the soldiers' vote where it's separately counted. I don't think you can call it terribly. It's not decisive in the final. Lincoln wins the Electoral College, 212 votes to 30-something, I think, is the final vote. So it's not terribly decisive. As an expression of a change, in 1862, after the proclamation is first announced, Lincoln says the troops are deserting. They're not fighting. They're less likely to go into the field. By 64, he's won their hearts against the general, the opposition candidate, who was brilliant enough never to send them into the field when it was possible to avoid a fight. Yeah. That's a great general to have.
Don't forget that Lincoln is running against a general. And so I think that Lincoln...
Loved by the Army of the Potomac.
Loved by the Army of the
For
Potomac.
For not
right.
fighting. It'll do it every time.
Right. He did a lot of training, but he didn't do enough fighting, right, according to Lincoln. But one of the things that I think Lincoln took heart at, and that is, you know, U.S. military had been losing a lot before this war. They had been losing a lot of men, losing a lot of ground, and they were really afraid that the Confederates were going to come into Washington. So that for him to win and then get that kind of support from his soldiers, I think, was really important to him. So I think from his point of view, it was very, very important and meaningful that he got 80% or more of the military vote.
Professor Blight thinks that this gentleman who's been so patient has got to just, why don't you shout out a question and we'll move on.
I want to make a comment that I
be qualified by referring to him as a gradualist. If you look at the fact that in the Lincoln-Douglas debates, it was clear that his rooted beliefs were in the Declaration of Independence, and we didn't achieve as a nation a colorblind constitution as put by John Marshall Harlan until 1954. Lincoln accelerated our moral and political development at a very great pace, and he was anything but a gradualist.
I think that's a wonderful place to end from with that. Absolutely. But before you go, David Blight referred to Douglass's changing views, changing autobiography, changing sense of self. He gave several speeches about Abraham Lincoln. The best known was at the dedication of the Freedmen's Memorial in Washington, this extraordinary sculpture of a slave either kneeling or rising, depending on your point of view. Some believe it's politically incorrect now, but it's an extraordinary work of art. And it's now become the centerpiece of the D.C. Emancipation Day festivities, which is an interesting change. Ulysses S. Grant unveiled a statue and sat down without saying a word. He overdid his silent reputation. Frederick Douglass gave one of the great, I think, the greatest speech ever given about Abraham Lincoln from 1876. And let's end with those remarks from Charles Turner.
Fellow citizens, the 14th day of April, 1865, of which this is the 11th anniversary, is now and will ever remain a memorable day in the annals of the Republic. It was on the evening of this day, while a fierce and sanguinary rebellion was in the last stages of its desolating powers, while its armies were broken and scattered before the invincible armies of Grant and Sherman, while a great nation, torn and rent by war, was already beginning to raise to the skies loud anthems of joy at the dawn of peace, it was startled, amazed, and overwhelmed by the crowning crime of slavery, the assassination of Abraham Lincoln. It was a new crime, a pure act of malice. No purpose of the rebellion was to be served by it. It was the simple gratification of a hell-black spirit of revenge. But it has done good after all. It has filled the country with a deeper abhorrence of slavery and a deeper love for the great liberator. Had Abraham Lincoln died from any of the numerous ills to which flesh is heir, had he reached that good old age of which his vigorous constitution and his temperate habits gave promise, had he been permitted to see the end of his great work, had the solemn curtain of death come down but gradually, we should still have been smitten with a heavy grief and treasured his name lovingly. But dying as he did die, by the red hand of violence, killed, assassinated, and taken off without warning, not because of personal hate, for no man who knew Abraham Lincoln could hate him, but because of his fidelity to union and liberty, he is doubly dear to us, and his memory will be precious forever. Fellow citizens, I end as I began, with congratulations. We have done a good work for our race today in doing honor to the memory of our friend and liberator. We have been doing highest honors to ourselves and those who come after us. We have been fastening ourselves to a name and fame imperishable and immortal. We have also been defending ourselves from a blighting scandal. When now it shall be said that the colored man is soulless, that he has no appreciation of benefits or benefactors, when the foul reproach of ingratitude is hurled at us and it is attempted to scourge us beyond the range of human brotherhood, we may calmly point to the monument we have this day erected to the memory of Abraham Lincoln.
Frederick Douglass for president.
Thank you, Charles Turner, Jim Horton, Harold Holzer, David Blight. Thank you, wonderful audience. Please stay for our reception, and let's give them another hand. Thanks.